Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
89.7 in the Mat-Su Valley, radiofreepalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on iTunes. Just search for Dog Works Radio, and calling in from California is our co-host. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
Real nice and warm here, and so everyone's looking forward to summer, as I'm sure is happening up there as well, and I just tested for and got my black belt in Taekwondo earlier this week, so I'm very excited about that.
You know, I saw that post on Facebook. You are a pure stud. What is happening with that black belt? I know I heard about it before, but man, that's an amazing accomplishment.
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit difficult to train in Taekwondo when you're over the age of 40. You know, because you're not nearly as flexible, but after a while, I guess you realize that you're not so much competing with everybody else, but competing to make your life the best that it can be. And so once I got that attitude adjustment, it all kind of fell into place. I've been training for about 2.5 years, and I just took my black belt test, and among the things that I was most scared of but am most proud about is I broke a brick with my bare hand. So I broke a brick that was about 3 inches thick just by concentrating and hitting it with great force.
Wow. That is an amazing feat, Alex. I am definitely honored to know a true black belt out there. That is a cool feat. So with all that training, what does that enable you to do? Can you go out there and beat up Chuck Norris now?
I'm pretty sure I can't beat up Chuck Norris, but you know what it's done is, for me, it's just given me a different way of looking at the world and looking at my interactions with people. I don't so much want to fight anybody, although I never did. But if I'm in a situation where, you know, something is happening and somebody is in danger, I feel that now I have tools that I can deal with that I didn't have before.
Excellent. So what is next? I understand in some of the other martial arts type sports, there are different degrees of black belts, you know, first degree, second degree, et cetera, et cetera. What's next for you? Are you at a good spot now?
I'm at a good spot for the moment. I definitely want to keep training. And there are, in Taekwondo, there are also many, many different degrees of black belt that you can get. I'm not exactly sure what form my training is going to be in, but you know, for the moment, I'm just celebrating this accomplishment, and I'll figure out what I'm going to do next in a couple weeks.
Well, there you go. I guess if you're a bricklayer and you need some bricks broken up in the yard, we have a man to call. Give Alex Stein a call. He is on Facebook. So, Alex, again, congratulations on that. I'm sure it's a well-deserved honor to be able to do that, because not many folks are that. But let's jump on over to our Mushing Radio show. You know, we have a lot to talk about here in the off season. I understand there's a really cool thing happening right now over on Mount Everest. Is that right?
Yeah, and you know, we just saw this story this afternoon. I guess it was posted late yesterday. Larry Daugherty, who has been on the show and who is a I believe an Anchorage-based oncologist, has run the Iditarod a couple of times. He is, perhaps fans might remember him as being the guy who travels on the Iditarod Trail with the Tibetan prayer flags, which have the names of patients he's treated who have not survived. Very interesting and really amazing guy. Does a lot of stuff in terms of climbing mountains and adventures and things like that. Really someone who is not only committed to mushing, but also to the entire idea of giving back to your community, however you define that community. And he had announced earlier that this year he was going to go to Mount Everest and try to climb Mount Everest after the Iditarod, and he is up there now. And people may remember there was a story a couple years ago where Steve Watkins, who was a rookie in 2015 and finished Iditarod, went to climb Everest after the 2015 Iditarod, and there was a very significant earthquake. And he and others were evacuated from the mountain. I believe he was in base camp. Yes, he was in base camp and was evacuated. There was a significant loss of life in the area. And so his team that he was up there with made the decision that they were going to come off the mountain and not summit. But he had brought with him his Iditarod finisher's belt buckle, and his intent was to take the belt buckle up to the summit of Mount Everest. But when the earthquake struck, they had to evacuate relatively quickly, and he lost in the earthquake and in all the stuff that happened afterwards, he lost his Iditarod belt buckle. So fast forward 2 years, and Larry Doherty is on Mount Everest right now at the base camp, and he just posted this picture of him with a metal detector. And I'm just going to read from his Facebook post because I think he said it perfectly. He said, hauling a metal detector up to Everest base camp was the easy part. Finding a lost Iditarod finisher belt buckle from the 2015 earthquake could be a bit more challenging, but I've linked up with the climbing company used by Steve Watkins, who seemed to know exactly where his tent was when the avalanche struck base camp. So today, here's to hope we find it. We were all relieved when we learned Steve was unharmed at Camp 1, but losing the buckle he'd planned to take to the summit was heartbreaking. Probably an impossible task to find it, but I do enjoy an impossible challenge from time to time.
Wow. You know, that is an awesome story. You know, I remember when that happened, and I knew about Steve Watkins and what he was attempting to do, something very similar to what Larry is trying to do this year, doing Iditarod and then Everest just a couple of months later. And I remember when that happened, the earthquake, I was scouring the news because obviously that was the only person I knew of personally that was over there. So I was scouring the news hoping to find that he was out safe. And I remember they had that thing on Facebook where you can post, you know, I'm safe here or whatever. And he did that. And, you know, there was a sigh of relief, at least in the mushing community, I'm sure, you know, with his family and everywhere else. But what an amazing feat that Larry's trying to do. You know, Larry's been on this show two or three times now. He was last on 6 months or so ago when his son and he traveled to Africa to climb Kilimanjaro, and they were bringing over a whole bunch of radiation equipment to a very rural hospital there near that mountain. He's part of a nonprofit where they deliver medical supplies to cancer centers. And as you mentioned, he's a cancer doctor over here in the States. But this guy, you know, not only is he an awesome athlete, but he is a true ambassador, isn't he, Alex?
He really is. And I'm not really sure how well he knows Steve. I get the impression that they know each other, but they're not, you know, are not super close. But it all goes back to this idea that a lot of people talk about where the community of mushers and the community of Iditarod mushers especially is something that is very, very special. And once you're in that community, you're in that community. And the people in that community and the people close to them do everything they can to take care of their own. And that's why I thought this was such an amazing and wonderful story.
Well, you know, it's truly a needle in a haystack. Not only is it somewhere on the tallest mountain in the world there, but also under, I'm sure, quite a bit of debris from that earthquake. So we wish Larry the best and, of course, Steve with luck in finding it. And just a little bit of a backstory regarding those belt buckles. Just a couple of years ago, also in 2015, they had the large sockeye fire here, which I want to talk about in just a second, just a quick update to that. But Didi Genro lost her belt buckle in the fire that burned down her home. And I remember they found that in all of that burnt rubble. and it is now one of her prized possessions. And if I'm not mistaken, Alex, I believe that Iditarod wanted to give her a replacement with, you know, they stamp the year on it. You know, it's a brass belt buckle, and they stamp the year that you finished. But the most important thing about this story is you only get one of these belt buckles, and this is probably the most prized possession from an Iditarod finisher. I mean, that is not only an amazing accomplishment, but it's a little bit of a bragging right too. You know, you see them all over town here, you know, people wearing these belt buckles, you know, at the local grocery store and at picnics and all that sort of stuff. And it reminds me a whole lot of the rodeo guys who have those really big belt buckles that they win, you know, whether they're doing bull riding or whatever they're doing. And those are highly coveted items. It's sort of their trophy, isn't it, Alex?
Yeah, it really is. And the Iditarod Trail Committee has, through no fault of the musher's own, you know, like in a fire or the belt buckle being buried by the avalanche caused by this earthquake, if the buckle is lost, the Iditarod will make arrangements to replace it. But this is something that's very, very rare. I mean, Didi Genro has finished Iditarod dozens of times. She has one belt buckle. And Steve Watkins has finished Iditarod once, and he has a belt buckle. So it's another sign that you're part of this fraternity once you finish Iditarod.
Yeah, very similar. You mentioned a fraternity, very similar to that fraternity ring or that class ring from college or high school. I'm sure a lot of us had those back in the day, and that became sort of a prized possession. And it's very much the same with these Iditarod folks as well. Speaking of the Sockeye Fire, Alex, I know you and I have talked about this several times on the show. In June of 2015, there was a fire up here in Willow, Alaska, and it just spread like crazy, and a whole bunch of folks lost their homes and outbuildings, as well as several mushers, including Iditarod mushers, Didi Genro, and Justin and Jamie High, and Jan Steves and Bob Klupach, and several others lost pretty much everything from this very fast-moving wildfire. We had to evacuate our dogs as well as everybody in Willow because we had no idea if it was even going to reach us south. But just the other day, the trial got underway here in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley or the Matsu Borough where we live, and the two folks are going on trial. But it's interesting because it's just a bunch of misdemeanor counts, and mostly they're looking for just restitution, but there sure is an outrage, not only in the mushing community, but just about everybody else, that these folks, it's understanding or alleged that it was, deliberately set, and or they, you know, something caught fire and they took off without doing anything about it, whether it was a brush fire or fireworks or whatever. So now these two folks are on trial and they're literally just going to get a slap on the wrist. Have you read about this, and what are your thoughts about that?
I've read a little bit about it. I haven't been following it as closely as you have, but I think it's that the laws are just a little bit out of whack, and anyone looking at this can recognize that the punishment, if they're found guilty, is not going to do anything to really right all the harm that's been caused by what they did. And you know, part of it is that I don't know. You would have to go back and look at the laws, but I'm not sure what the total damage was from that fire. But just in terms of people who lost their homes, we're talking about millions or maybe tens of millions of dollars, and that's also not counting all of the cost of fighting the fire and all of the cost of everything else that happened as a result of it. And you know, for someone to get a small fine, you know, or a relatively small fine, or maybe even a very small jail sentence, there's something that seems definitely out of whack with that.
Yeah, and you know, the couple that are on trial, you know, they were business owners here, and they actually owned a audiovisual supply type business down in Anchorage, and they've since closed that business, and I'm sure, you know, did whatever they had to do to, you know, sort of settle their affairs, so to speak, before they went on trial. But, you know, sort of the grumblings is that these guys don't have any money anyway, whether they are forced to pay restitution or whatever. But kind of a sad side note to this, and I know you've been up here in this area, and construction is a little different than your typical community. A lot of folks around here hand-built their homes, so they don't have mortgages, and many of them don't have insurance. So when these cabins burn to the ground, they are unable to receive any type of compensation from an insurance settlement or anything like that, because it's just not there like you would normally find in the big city, where you're required to have insurance if you have a mortgage, or, you know, if you're renting a place, you're covered by your landlord or whatever. But many places up here don't have that.
Yeah, and it's the sort of thing where you look for someone that will help make you whole, whether that's the insurance company or trying to go after the assets of the person responsible, you know, in court. But as you were saying, it sounds like these people just don't have a lot of assets, and certainly not a lot to cover the cost and the replacement cost and new construction and all of that. So it's really just it continues to be a very, very sad situation.
Well, one last note on that. I just drove through that area just this past weekend. I was heading up to Fairbanks and hadn't driven up that way in a while. And it's amazing that everything is spurring back to life in that area. You know, the trees are coming back. Plant life is arriving. And there's so many new homes on these burned out lots. You know, I'm certain that many of them did not replace it with what they lost. A lot of them are smaller homes or smaller cabins that are built along the highway there. But I know Dee Dee and the Highs, and I know the Klupatches and Bob Klupatch and Jan Steves, they all replaced their homes. And what's amazing about that is not 6-7 months later, after that devastating fire, that Dee Dee Genro signed up and ran Iditarod again after all that adversity.
Yeah. There's quite a few people who suffered just amazing, enormous losses in the Sockeye fire, and yet were able to come back and run Iditarod. And we talked about that a little bit at the time and I think a little bit since then. But it's, I have great admiration for anyone who can run a 1,000-mile dog race anyway. But to be able to do that with the stress that comes from having lost your home and having had to rebuild it, and all of, you know, anyone who's ever dealt with the government or with an insurance company knows that those sort of things are just nightmares. And anyone who could be able to get through that nightmare and then run and do well in a 1,000-mile dog race is just, my hat is off to them.
Right. And just on a personal note, we did have insurance, and we weren't affected by the fire in any way. And just like in any other type of thing, when something happens like that, your insurance rates go up like crazy. And ours went up by a few $100 a year just because of that act. So even though we weren't directly affected by the fire itself, and these two individuals that are now on trial, we're even feeling it ourselves, even if it's just a little bit of a pinch in the pocketbook. Natural disasters affect everybody in a community, don't they?
Yeah, they really do.
All right, so let's switch gears a little bit. We had a lot of current events there. I just wanted to do a quick update on that since we're sort of off-season now. But, you know, one of our most asked-about stories about Iditarod is about the Widow's Lamp, which is different than the Red Lantern Award. I know we talk about the Red Lantern Award every year when we cover our Iditarod, our daily coverage on Iditarod. But the Widow's Lamp is a different story, isn't it, Alex?
Yeah, and for me, the Widow's Lamp is one of the most touching things about Iditarod. And this goes back to an old tradition going back to going back in Alaska to when dog sleds were used to deliver mail and supplies. And when a musher was on his way into a lodge, the lodge would be notified that, that this person was coming in, and then the lodge would put a lamp outside to light the way in and to you know, to serve as a signal that this is where you're heading to. There are similar things sometimes that you know, in fishing communities, that people will put lanterns or leave lights on for their people who are out at sea, and it's called a widow's lamp. And so when Iditarod started, or a few years into Iditarod, they decided to honor this tradition. So every year they light a lamp that they put on the Burled Arch, and that lamp stays there lit day and night until the very last musher comes in. And then the lamp is taken down and the musher extinguishes it, and that is the official end of the Iditarod. So it's not quite that it ends when the last musher comes in, because there's that one last thing, and I usually am watching it live on the cameras when it happens, and it's always, for me, it's a very emotional moment, because it signifies that everything that has gone on in that year's Iditarod is now over, and all of the hard efforts that everyone has put in and all of the challenges that they've faced and overcome have been met.
Right. And, you know, as we mentioned, the Red Lantern is something else in entirety, but it sort of goes back to that folklore with the widow's lamp. But what's interesting about these lamps, especially back in the early days, you had mentioned that a lot of these roadhouses or homes or cabins along the way would have these lights out, sort of like a vacancy sign at a modern hotel. If the light was on, you're welcome to come in. You know, our home is open. We're welcoming you in. And if the light was off, either the folks weren't home or they weren't welcoming visitors or they had too many people there or whatever. So very similar to that vacancy sign that we see along the highways as we're doing our road trips. But what else is cool, Alex, is all along the trails, Iditarod Trail, the Yukon Quest Trail, and many other trails here in Alaska, there's a lot of public use cabins that are always open, and folks are often found stopping at these roadhouses or these public use cabins to get out from the weather, to rest, to, you know, to bed down their dog teams and this sort of thing. And they just sort of just leave them open for folks to use. And I know that's a hard concept to understand, especially if you live in the city where crime is rampant. Many folks would never leave, you know, their front door unlocked or, you know, invite strangers in. It's just purely an Alaskan tradition, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's important to realize, too, that especially during the winter, these cabins and these public these publicly available shelters can be really vitally important, because although we haven't seen it so much in the past few years, you know, weather can change very, very quickly. Blizzards can come in, or you can just be out on the trail for a long time and it's 60 or 70 degrees below zero. So the idea of having these cabins at regular intervals, well, not regular intervals, but these cabins that everyone knows where they are and that they're available and open, and you can go in there and get out of the weather or you know, just rest for a little bit while, that can sometimes mean the difference between life and death.
Right. And you know what a cool story is? I know you and I have talked about this several times. It's the old woman's cabin there on the Iditarod Trail, and sort of the superstition or the folklore is that if you come to visit there, you always leave candy for the ghost of the old woman. Do you know anything about that story?
You know, I don't know much beyond what you just said, but I do know that several people have reported that when they when they were staying there, that they either saw, you know, a ghostly figure, they saw something in the distance, or they, you know, they stopped there and they took a nap, and when they woke up, something of theirs, something small of theirs was missing. And, you know, everyone just sort of says, oh, well, it was the old woman who took it.
You know, when I was helping out the folks that were running the serum run a few years ago, that was a mandatory piece of gear. I remember the lady that I was helping. She said, here's my little bag of candy for the old woman at Old Woman Cabin. It looked like a little bag of Halloween candy with the little Snickers and, you know, the sweet tarts or whatever. So it was something that they really thought about, or they really put some effort into, that, you know, superstitions are different for many people, but I guess, you know, that superstition has been around so long, it's sort of become almost a custom, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. And, you know, we can look at it in a lot of different ways, and sometimes I get very analytical about these things, and I start saying to myself, you know, stuff like, well, this is very late into the race. And this is at a point where people have had almost no sleep for a week or whatever. And so it makes sense that they would start hallucinating and that they would see these things. So that's part of me says that. But the other part of me just believes every single thing that I hear about this.
And you know what else was cool on that serum run planning is this same lady. She was the musher coordinator. She bought a whole bunch of cheeseburgers from McDonald's before they left and froze them and put them in bags and secretly tucked them away in their gear. And at some portion, very late into the expedition, like well into week one or early on week two, she brought out these hamburgers that had been frozen for, you know, a better part of 2 weeks, and she said that she does this every time they go on serum run, and it is one of the greatest treats to these folks that have been, you know, eating camp food for 2 weeks and, you know, tired and hadn't had showers, and then all of a sudden, you know, they heat up a frozen McDonald's hamburger, and it's like a steak dinner to these folks.
Yeah, and it's funny that sometimes you get these sort of things where, you know, especially if you live in the city, you might think, oh, McDonald's, who wants McDonald's? And, you know, but there is a great familiarity a great comfort in having something that familiar that's suddenly available to you that can remind you of home, or that can, you know, be comforting when you're hundreds of miles down the trail.
Right. Well, Alex, great show for sure. You know, we went into this morning not really having a topic to talk about. It's tough to come up with topics in the off season. You know, all the races are done. You know, everybody's sort of settling down for, you know, the next few months before fall training kicks in late August. But we will be on, as usual, on our normal spot. But do you have any idea of some up-and-coming topics that you would be interested in? I would like to open it up for our listeners to possibly give us some topics as well.
Yeah, you know, I would really love to hear what anyone listening would like to hear about or like to talk about, or if they have questions. You know, we both are very available on social media, on Facebook and on Twitter. So if there is anything that any of you guys are interested in, just hit us up, and we'll get to it as soon as we can.
Excellent. All right, Alex, it's always a pleasure. Again, congrats for the black belt. Don't go out there and hunt down Chuck Norris this afternoon and you know, get cocky out there with that thing. I know that is a tongue-in-cheek joke. So, but, yeah, again, congratulations on that for sure, and best of luck to you and whatever that does for you in terms of furthering your education. I look forward to your updates. So we will definitely talk again soon. On behalf of my co-host Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto and Mushing Radio. Make sure you check us out on the web at dogworksradio.com. That's where all of our archived episodes are. And do us a favor and head on over to iTunes, search for Dogworks Radio. Give us a review there, and if you really like us, hit that subscribe button and you'll end up right in your inbox or on your iPhone or Android or whatever you have every week when we're on. Alex, thanks again. We'll talk soon, okay?
Okay. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. See you guys next time.